And I am, there we go. But I'm going to cut it when we come to our discussion because I figure probably you wouldn't want whatever you were saying here to be thrown out there on the public airwaves. So I'll try and do that to kind of keep our own confidentiality inside of here. So having said all that, let's start. Okay, Unspeakable Ache, let me just introduce it this way again. That's sort of the title of this class here. Three just really quick things I want to say about it. This whole idea of the unspeakable ache. The first one is it's a frustrating topic. It's frustrating because it's not the conversation we normally have at all with anybody, sometimes even with our closest people in our lives. And yet, and we also don't even know how to put words to it. Often we don't even have a vocabulary for this. And that's why it's called unspeakable. So I like to say it's a frustrating topic, but it's also a painful topic. It's not one we're, you know, drawn to simply because it does arouse a lot of pain. It's like in your own body. You know, you don't even think about our bodies until usually they're in pain. You know, until you have the throat that's sore, if you've had that recently, or the collarbone that's broken, or the hip that needs perhaps a replacement. You aren't even aware of these things. And the unspeakable ache comes up as an awareness and often as a pain. And we become aware of things in our hearts that we aren't even aware of before until this sort of thing happens. It's a summons. Actually, I like to think of it this way. The ache is a summons out of our own spiritual lethargy and mediocrity because you have to do something with it. Sadly, much of what the human race does tends to be tragic. But in that sense, it is painful. The last thing, it's not only frustrating and painful, it is universal. You can be a Christian in China, a Hindu in India, an agnostic in France. I don't care what your religious or lack of religious background is. These aches are universal. They are the human condition. They are part of being alive or asleep as a part of the human race. As such, I think in a postmodern world, speaking about these things may be one of our evangelistic tools that we do have. For those who've completely dismissed the Christian faith, because you can't dismiss these aches. They are there. They're all in all of us. But if we seek to really listen to the ache, it can do something wonderful. It drives us forward into the arms of the Father. That's the bottom line. That's why we even come here to talk about them. So, let me talk about how the ache service this week. And actually, I think I have this running. Yeah, there we go. Okay, how the ache service this week. Many of you know that I've stopped teaching full-time at the academy after 20 years of teaching and coaching, which was a rather fearsome jump for me. But I did it, and I'm still teaching one class there. It's my Men in the Bible class, and it's the one that I've really enjoyed teaching the last 4 or 5 years, and so I wanted to keep that one. And that class begins with, it's just for young men, and there's a Women in the Bible class there too. Because we're an equal opportunity employer at the school. But this is just for young men. And I opened the class up on the first day with a big question on the board, what's a real man? And that's the whole semester. That is the entire semester trying to get them to wrap their heads and hearts around good and bad answers to that question. Well, recently we've taken up the topic of females, beauty, and the heart of a woman. And, you know, I teach in some ways similar to what I do in here. You know, we have discussion times, we look at scripture, we do movie clips, and we kind of roll that all together, storytelling. But instead of discussion after the end of each class, like in here, what I do is we'll take a topic and chew it apart. And then at the end, I do something that I've termed SSQ, you know, and it's one of the things I've learned as a teacher. If you come up with sort of code topics or names for things that sort of prick students' interest. So SSQ just means statement, story, question. Here's how it works. I throw up 3 or 4 questions, very much like what I do in here, on the board. And then they have some sort of object that we pass around the class. And they all have to touch the object. And as they touch the object, they have to pick one of the questions and answer it with a statement, of story, or question. So it's real open-ended where they want to go or how much they want to talk, but everybody has to say something in the class. So this particular day, this happened this week on Wednesday. I found a wiffle ball, so we were just throwing that around, and that was everybody had to touch it by the end to say that they had each contributed something to the conversation. So the questions were about dating, relationships with women in general, pornography, and then kind of any other questions they wanted to surface and talk about. So we started, and you know, the conversation kind of went on. It kind of careened in and out of various topics. But all of a sudden, as we approached towards the end, a young man decided to go deeper, you know, and he just sort of opened the door into a further level of sort of emotional and sexual struggles that young men have here. And another young man was so sparked by what he had heard, he had already talked, that he literally said, "I got to say something." And he literally took the wiffle ball again, even though he had already touched it once. And he proceeded to kind of walk down that same path and talk. It was one of those magical moments. You teachers, you know what I'm talking about. It's one of those moments where you don't want the class bell to ring. Nobody wanted the class bell to ring. Everybody just wanted to stay there for a moment. But the class bell rang. And I knew it had touched a really raw nerve because I watched the classmates go around this young man who talked at the end and thank him for going there. You know, they had seen somebody who simply had the bravery and fortitude to go to a place that's really hard. You know, and this is what the ache for intimacy is all about. It's something we long for and we're terrified of all at the same time. And that push-pull is the driving force behind every relationship, starting with marriage and moving on down. We long for it and we're terrified of it. And what do we do with that? It is the human dilemma. And that's what we want to explore in this part of the Unspeakable Ache. So that's how it came up for me, watching that moment in that class. It was just, it was a transcendent moment. Okay, let's go here now. Let's move into where I want to go today, which is this whole ache for intimacy in the family. So let me speak about it briefly. And again, pull it up with a story from a movie, and then let's explore this today and begin the conversation. So again, what's the ache for intimacy? This is just a working definition, and here's the words I put to it. It is the longing to know the hearts of others and to be known. And in that unveiling, to experience a connection, a bond, that's both wonderful and powerful. And in that bond, we feel safe and we come alive. That is what happens when we begin the touch. The ache for intimacy is aroused and touched. So we've approached this through sports, if you remember. We talked about it through teamwork. That's sort of how that is aroused. And that sort of, it doesn't have to be sports, any sort of team thing where people come together and accomplish something that's really more than they could have individually. And I remember the first time I was a part of a high school play, I experienced that. You know, we just do something that together is remarkable. And then we approached it last week through the giving and receiving of secrets and kind of how that happens when we begin to tell secrets and receive secrets from others. But this, I want to walk through a different door today. I want to walk through it through the door of the family. And the way I want to do it is with this. We Bought a Zoo is a movie that came out in 2011. Any of y'all saw? Yeah, We Bought a Zoo. It's one of those kind of, I thought it was a rather silly story, but it's actually a true story. And underneath the supposed silliness of it, it is a deep movie with some incredibly powerful moments in it. It's a true story based on the Englishman Benjamin Mee, whose wife died of a brain tumor. And to help overcome the grief of it, he decided to buy a zoo in England. It's a true story. It's a dilapidated zoo. They were going to put down all the animals. And he felt if they just started their life over, moved to a new place, maybe connected to animals, somehow that would help them through this time of grief. But there are, of course, many obstacles in the way, both financial, and that's really a true part of the story. He literally came to this point of, he just thought the creditors were going to take the zoo back because it was in such need of repair. But there are also some, in the movie, some very much relational struggles. There are two children who are left with the single, with Benjamin, the single father now, and they are Dylan and Rosie in the movie. And as you'll see, Rosie is the young girl who has just a way of getting inside of his father, of her father's heart. But Dylan has also sunk into this depression with sullen outbursts. Sound like a sort of a, you know, a somewhat typical adolescent maneuver. And his introversion and surliness drive Benjamin crazy. Just drive him nuts. He doesn't know what to do with his son anymore. Benjamin also really struggles because he doesn't know how to talk to his children. Does that sound familiar? He doesn't know how to engage them. Finally, you have to know, when you hear Dylan has had this sort of thing with this girl named Lily, who also works out in the zoo, and yet they've had sort of a tiff. He doesn't know what to do with that. And then there's a Siberian tiger, whose name I can't remember right now, who is old and dying. And Benjamin just can't, you know, pull the trigger and let him go. So he's wrestling with that grief issue. So you're going to see all that arise. So let's watch this interaction.
I found some, right?
All right, so Rosie and I will go to the tiger enclosure and give them some water. Why don't you just go over to the garage and make sure the lights are off in the side room?
Dad, I have a sick amount of homework. Dad!
Get it done!
Come on, Spar, you gotta take your meds.
He looks tired, Dad.
He's gonna be okay. Isn't that right, buddy? See that? He likes us.
Dylan really loves you, you know?
I know.
He's just mad that his friends don't visit him here. He thought they would all visit, but nobody came.
Well, they will. Fans blowing on you.
I like it.
I can't even find you in here. You're like a Chilean miner. You're gonna have to go get Kelly and maybe even get McCready. Dig you out, my goodness. There's
no, but,
there's Rosie. Is that loud? don't look now. You're happy. Your happy is too loud, huh? Uh-oh, who's happy is loud? Now, what do we have here? It's our old friend, huh? I didn't think this one was going to make the trip.
Did Mama hurt a lot before she had to leave us?
Well, do you remember the night that we were tucking you in and you asked Mommy that? No?
No.
Well, she said that it looked worse than it felt. Remember, she said sometimes people look really sick, but they don't feel really sick. Do you feel like you can't see her?
Yeah.
You feel like you can't hear her voice?
Mm-hmm. But I know what to do. Catch her spirit.
Catch her spirit, that's right.
Okay,
look for it. There you go. And put it in your arm.
Yeah.
Oh, Sal, okay, get it. Hold it there. Can you see her?
Yeah.
Yeah? She's never far away.
Right there.
That's right. Mommy would always be in your heart and my shoulder. You ready to go to bed? Do you want to keep this? Okay, sweetheart. Goldfish I have. The cereal bar for you, you're late, dude. Did you even read that book?
You're funny with everyone else, but never with me, which I find funny.
Yeah, you know what I find funny? I gotta drive you 40,000 miles to school. Here you go, one, two, three, now. And don't think I don't notice you just changed the subject.
Dylan likes Lily.
Hey, she's way younger than me. She's 12, but it doesn't work like that.
She's about a foot taller.
Don't be a tiny person.
Idiot. Dude. Uncle Kelly. This one seems really not happy with me.
You got a big guy there, huh?
Yeah.
We live on a snake farm.
It's like oh, come on. Wow. Yeah, funny. Glad you guys are enjoying yourselves. Now, how could this even happen, man? I don't even know how you did this.
Tab, there's nothing you could say to me that's more harsh than what I'm saying to myself.
Oh, I disagree. I just want you to be happy, man. Unless you don't want to be happy.
What is so great about being happy?
That you're happy.
I'm sorry I messed up the box of snakes. Whatever!
You're not supposed to say that in this century.
He's so patronizing to me.
Nice word, hotshot.
Yeah. Whatever.
All right, hit the lights just for a second. I got one more very brief clip. But if you'll notice the interactions between who is the one who initiates the intimacy with Benjamin? Rosie does. And how does she do it? What grammatical construction does she use? Did you catch how she does it? Yeah, well, she initiates with a question. Did you know, in both sense, do you know that Dylan really loves you? Did mommy hurt when she died? You know, she's just willing to go there. And you can just see all of a sudden, Benjamin just sort of just goes, oh. Okay, and then what's Dylan? Dylan, and you can catch that, the interactions are like that through much of the movie. And they actually have one incredible shouting match. They're just totally missing each other. So what is Dylan doing as he's watching this very intimate moment in the bed with Rosie and her dad? Did you catch what was going on with him intuitively?
Right, was yearning for that.
Yeah, he was just yearning. You caught that also with the tear he's wiping away. He's yearning for that type of intimacy with his dad. He can't get there. They're just missing each other. You know, and of course, he's so depressed because he doesn't know what to do with his mom's death. And he's just doing the best he can, trying to figure out how to maneuver through all this. Okay, and so it just creates a lot of frustration. So let's watch one more clip. What they've had this shouting match, and all of a sudden they sort of meet each other the next morning in front of this Siberian tiger. So let's go here and pull this one up.
Oh.
happened with you and Lily?
I don't know. I guess I didn't listen to something she told me or something. I mean, I liked her. It's like you embarrass yourself if you say something, and you embarrass yourself if you don't.
I like it when you talk. You know, sometimes all you need is 20 seconds of insane courage. Just literally 20 seconds of just embarrassing bravery. And I promise you, something great will come of it.
I never know what to say to you.
Just tell each other what we wish the other guy would say.
I'm sorry I brought you out to the sticks.
You're a great dad.
Did your best, Dad. He knows that.
Okay, well, so how did they connect? Over a dying tiger. Did you catch that? And how did the connection start? They just admitted to each other. They have no idea how to talk to each other. It was an opening. And, you know, you saw the little shoving thing at the end. I mean, that's just sort of the, one of those typical ways men sort of show that they accept each other. You know, after working with young men, that's exactly how that happens. The family can be described and understood in many ways, but I think at the top of the list, or certainly near the top of the list, perhaps, is how families are supposed to touch this ache. Either through in a positive way or in a negative way by neglecting it or actually shattering it. For here is where a child first learns the meaning of intimacy, first bodily through touch and embrace, and then emotionally through the dialogue and conversation. And these interactions become emotional templates that pattern us for our sense of being and our sense of bonding long after we've left the home and long after our parents are dead and gone. My work with young men and women only confirms this over the years. No matter how independent, like Dylan was, a teenager may seem to be, they are always looking for home. They're always looking for a safe place. And if their real home is not a safe place, they will find it somewhere. They'll find it in a gang. They'll find it in a string of sexual liaisons. It doesn't really even, you know, it here, the ache for intimacy trumps morality. They will find it like a starving animal. The ache has become a throbbing pain and they have to do something with it. On the parental side of things, if you notice, Benjamin Mee's struggle to connect to his own children is the struggle of, you know, so many fathers in the helter-skelter, you know, of daily life of many dads. You know, we can just get so preoccupied or consumed with our own worlds, with our own needs. We just miss our children. I mean, we just miss them. We miss the cues they may throw out at us. We can just so easily miss the flags thrown up about what they long for. And in so doing, miss the most priceless thing of all, their hearts. In addition, like Benjamin, you know, as dads, and I think moms are much better with this, dads, we just don't know what to say to them. I mean, there were so many junctures as a parent. I just, you know, I there was something, I needed to say something, but I didn't know what to say. And if I pressed in, was I going to get a slam door? Was I going to get resentment? Was I going to get openness? You just don't know. These are the relational unknowns inside of all families. And sometimes I did what I feel many fathers do also. You just don't do anything. But as I've learned, that silence is also communicating. Actually, it's communicating something very, very deafening. Children long to connect to their parents. They ache for it. It's almost a bodily ache. And we need to initiate, especially us dads. Even in our mistakes, we'll learn what it means to love better. For Heidi and I, it's this sort of kind of struggling with intimacy in our own family. It's meant sort of two different maneuvers. And one is that we've, with both of our daughters, we've tried to tell parts of our heart story to them, age appropriate. But we've tried to really invite them into our own stories and struggles by just simply going there at times and letting them know what's gone on inside of us, inside of our hearts, what our hopes and fears are, our struggles, our walk with God. But there's been a second maneuver, and that's the way we sort of invite them in. But there's a second maneuver that came with that, that I learned from my mistakes particularly, was that we learned that you, when you do that, you cannot demand any kind of response. Because demanding an intimacy or oil and water, the motions of the heart cannot be obligatory. They cannot be mandated. They can only be wooed and drawn out and aroused. And when we talk like that with our children, we simply learn to allow them to respond in whatever they want to. Even no response. That's just not our domain. It doesn't mean that we don't initiate questions. It just that means that with the questions, we just knock. We don't, you know, slam the door down. Let's go one other place today. And this place, which is... There it is. The script. Let me open the scriptures to just two passages on family connection, and which, in light of this, I find so intriguing. The first one is the way the whole Old Testament closes. The whole Old Testament, at least in the English version, closes. And it's the prophecy of Malachi, which is the very last prophet chronologically. And it's the very last verse of Malachi. So in a sense, it's the last verse of the Old Testament. So I want to read it to you with all of this as a backdrop. And I'll start actually at verse 4, because this is Malachi 4, verse 4, and I'll read to verse 6. And this is how Malachi closes. Remember the law of my servant Moses, the decrees and the laws that I gave him at Horeb for all Israel. See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, or else I will come and strike the land with a curse. Intriguing, isn't it? Elijah, in some sense, John the Baptist was a fulfillment of that. The day of the Lord, when Jesus came, was not the V-Day, climactic moment in history. It was sort of a D-Day invasion. And yet we know the redemption that Jesus empowered and began to bring forth certainly is supposed to find its way inside of the family structures. And this is how it's stated in Malachi. There's supposed to be a turning of the hearts and the fathers to each other. Now, of course, mothers are implied in this. But as we all know, fathers hold the key, the linchpin in a family system. We just do, whether we want that kind of power or not. And what does it mean for fathers and children to have their hearts turned toward each other? Well, at the very least, his children gladly and willingly honor their parents and find it easy to honor them. And secondly, parents willingly sacrifice for their children and find it easy and okay to sacrifice. Maybe not easy, but they're willing to go there. But even more than that, children are willing to receive instruction, as Paul talks about, instruction in the Lord, because their hearts are tuned in. They're not doing this motion, you know, where I just don't want that, whatever that is. Their hearts have been tuned in. And finally, this text implies, I think, something more. For when our hearts are turned towards each other, there's the possibility of heart connection. The ache for intimacy can be aroused and touched in the way I only know how to describe it as magical. It's the moment I experienced in that classroom with those young men. It's the moment you saw on the screen between Dylan and his father. There was a turning. And even in their admitting that they miss each other, there was a connection. When we hear this expression, y'all heard it, home is where the heart is. I think this is what the scriptures are alluding to here. Of course, the alternate possibilities put forth in this prophecy, one of destruction and curse that will come if that doesn't happen or if there's not a motion towards that. And of course, to reject Elijah and to reject the message of Jesus and down through redemptive history is to invite the curse. And this curse here is in the family. It's particularly talked about. And of course, this does need no explanation. You and I know of multiple examples of this all around us, of families in devastation. And you may see it in your own family. But it doesn't have to be this way. Another option is before us. But I want to take it one little step further to finish today, and that's to draw your attention to one last verse, which is out of the book of John 14 and 23. The intimate moment between the father and the son, between Dylan and his father and Rosie and the dad, I think it's really important for us to be aware of or to think about what you felt in those two moments. What was pulled up inside of you? I'll tell you what was pulled up inside of me. When I watch that, something inside of me awakens and I'm drawn there. It's like a fire. I want to get near it. I just want to put my hands. You know when you're really cold, you do this, and then you turn around and you do this. You just want to get warmed in it. What if such an intimacy between a father and a son was something more than watching it on a screen? What if it's something that's real, not just between our own children, but something we can be drawn into that's bigger than us? John 14:23 gives this intriguing proposition. Jesus is speaking, again, this is the Last Supper discourse. If anyone loves me, he will obey my teaching. My Father will love him. We will come to him, and listen to this, make our home with him. Jesus intrigues us with the thought that if we choose to draw close to him in love and obedience, we're going to get, and turning our heart towards him, we're going to get drawn into something much bigger. We're going to get drawn into the intimacy between the Father and the Son, the Father, the Son, the bond from which all bonding emanates, the intimacy from which all intimacy flows. We're invited to come in. Feel the warmth of that. They're actually going to make our home in us. That's stunning. And in that warmth, to find our hearts be softened and then conformed into true sons and daughters. This is our true home. This is where the heart is.